This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Prissy Carey, a.k.a. M.F. Grimm, is probably the only successful rapper to have gotten his start on Sesame Street. He may also be the only Sesame Street alum who became a narcotics dealer and barely survived a murder attempt by rival dealers. The bullets paralyzed him from the waist down. In 2000, he was sentenced to life on narcotics and conspiracy charges. In prison, he studied law and filed countersuits. His sentence was reduced, and he was released in 2003. Prissy Carey tells his story in a new graphic memoir illustrated by Ronald Wimberly. It's called Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm. Now Carey's business is legit. He runs his own underground hip-hop label called Day by Day and has returned to recording. Here's a track from his 2006 triple CD American Hunger. It's called Page Six, named after the gossip page in the New York Post.
The world will help you climb, cause they love a superstar. Someone has to crash and burn, so they love a superstar. And yes, I'm a superstar, darling of PR. Paparazzi shoot from close and far, even in private, no moments alone.
I heard he's been through hell. Do his rap music really sell? Among the elite, will he prevail? Is he on his way back to jail? Red Daddy shot it out with the cops. Beat his ass until he dropped. Threw him in a cell, told him to rot. Who do he know and how did he get out? Can he walk? Cause I heard he's wheeling. Over drugs involving dealings. Shot 10 times, do we have feelings? Heard he's violent, do we have feelings? Got a girl, do we have feelings? Life story so appealing. Not just us, okay, Globe. Inquiring minds, they all wanna know.
Prissy Carey, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, your book starts with you getting shot during a blizzard in 1994. So let's start there. You were on your way to sign a record deal with Atlantic Records. You were driving with your brother Jay in a blizzard. What do you remember about the attack?
Well, actually, the car was parked, and it was just snow all over the place. We were getting into the car. Couldn't see anything. The windows were covered with snow. It was coming down hard. And actually, the last thing I remember and will never forget is the fact that Jay said that today was going to be the first day of our life, of our new life.
Because of the record deal?
Yes. You know, there was no looking back. You know, we didn't have to do things that were considered, obviously were considered illegal or just not law-abiding, period. And, you know, we were looking forward to it. We were looking forward to a different type of life.
So then what happened?
From there, that's where the gunfire started. And was shot several times.
Your brother Jay was killed pretty instantly. How many Yes. times were you shot, and where were you shot?
I was shot 7 times from my neck. I had a bullet ricochet in my head and come out my mouth. Arm, sides, back, just multiple shots. I look like a Dalmatian, to be honest. But all around, mostly mid-body.
Do you know who attacked you? Not that I'm expecting you to name them by name, but, I mean, do you know who it was? It sounds like you don't want to say.
Well, actually, it's just that it's so, I put that so behind me that I don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because at that time and with the things I was doing, I put myself in that predicament. So I'm just as guilty, if not more guilty, than the people who actually shot me. So to make a long story short about who shot me, yeah, I'm aware who shot me, you know, in my own way, in my own sense, because I've done a lot of things myself.
Do you remember when you came out of the coma and realized that you were partially paralyzed? I think at the time you still didn't have Your hearing and your vision hadn't returned yet?
No. I was blind, I was deaf, and I was paralyzed. But there were things, those were things that I didn't even pay attention to, if it makes any sense. Okay, the sight, that kind of automatically, you're like, what's going on? I can't see. You know, the hearing, I was aware that I was shot, you know, and I had a bullet in my head. So the ringing and the non-hearing, I've dealt with. The paralysis itself, it didn't dawn on me because I knew my body went through a certain amount of trauma. So my assumption was I couldn't move just because of the trauma, not that I was, any nerves were severed or things of that nature. So it took me some time to understand that I was paralyzed.
How much of your body is paralyzed now?
I'm what's considered a T4 paraplegic, thoracic fourth bone, which is like right under my chest. You follow
mm-hmm,
me?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm paralyzed from there down, but it's interesting because all my sensation came back. A lot has changed. I was told that I was severed and I would be like that the rest of my life. A lot has changed since that time. So to state what type of paraplegic I am is difficult because I'm considered T4, thoracic, but I can feel all the way to my toes now.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's great.
I can slightly constrict my muscles and start moving somewhat.
After you were shot and then survived, you ended up going back to the life you were living beforehand. You ended up going back to that gangster kind of life and dealing drugs again. And I guess I'm wondering, why go right back into that world where you're likely to be shot again?
Well, I have to say, in my point of view, it's economics. Because if I wasn't in this chair right now and I walked outside and I tried to get a job, it would be very difficult for me to get a job. It's not impossible, but it would be difficult. To be in a wheelchair with my record and things to that nature, it made it harder to get a job. I've attempted to get employment and work in even pet stores. I've tried everything. And it was difficult. I was on Social Security, SSI. I was receiving, I believe, $200, $300 maybe a month to live off of. Food stamps, I believe it was like $70 a month to live off of. And that's not including the fact of medical supplies, medical situations. Like, if I needed medical supplies, I paid for it. And bottom line, I'm also a distributor. I don't know if you're aware of that, but I have a distribution company, music.
Oh, Day by Day Records.
That's Day by Day Entertainment. Yeah, it's an international distribution company. So I deal with companies around the globe, Australia, Japan. So it wasn't all just about selling drugs. It was, for me, it was to try to make a transition.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the narcotic itself was something I was able to get my hands on because it was available. And I chose to take that and sell it to make a profit so I can put into myself.
I guess, you know, I'm wondering why you got into the gangster life and dealing drugs in the first place. And I ask this because...
Temptation.
Wait. Yeah, well, let me just go backtrack a second and say that you were, like, really lucky when you were a kid. I mean, you were one of the kids on Sesame Street. So,
yes.
Like, on your resume, by the time you were a teenager, you had Sesame Street. So, I mean, there's so many things. As a performer, as somebody who wanted to, like, make records, like, you really could have used that to help parlay that into a career. So how did you end up in the gangster life as opposed to just kind of heading right toward show business?
Well, I have to say, up to that period of time, you're talking about, you said like 14. Before that, yes, I was on Sesame Street. It was great. I've done several other things in between, I mean, go all the way up to about, I guess maybe I was 10, 11.
Mm-hmm.
But 14, that was a different age, and it was a different era. I don't want to say I fell into any type of peer pressure, but temptation itself is a test that man has been going through since the beginning of time. And not every man has successfully overcome it.
You did time on charges of dealing narcotics and having illegal guns. You got out on bail for $100,000, and on the last day of your bail, you spent that day recording an album, a CD.
Yes, yes,
called
correct.
The Downfall of Iblis. Correct me if I'm not saying that correctly.
No, that's correct.
Subtitled A Ghetto Opera. And
yes.
How did that feel to record an album knowing that next day you're going to be in prison? And it was, at the time it was 15 years to life. You ended up getting out after 3 years, but you didn't know
yes.
that would happen. So you're facing 15 years to life and you're recording an album. Just describe how that felt that day in the studio, knowing what lay ahead of you.
That was the beauty of the album, because I didn't know what lied ahead of me. So creating the songs, I believe most of those songs were really questions to myself of what's going to become of the future. It was an album that I didn't have no answers to. Like every other album I have, as far as I'm concerned, are answers. It's my reply to how I see the world and things of that nature. But that was the only album that I had no certainty whatsoever of my future.
I want to play the track Howl. Would you say
sure.
something about it before we hear it?
Well, Howl is I basically compare life in America, or at least a specific type of style of life, to the life of being in a wolf in a wolf pack. So it's like Nature Channel.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Howl, and this is M.F. Grimm.
In darkness, sometimes sunshine, drunk off death, throwing up moonshine, slit veins, sit still, crush all bones, brittle, no pain, quick kill, maybe hurt just a little, hunger on cellular, yes, we call you, don't have a prayer, say one for you, shake life out, body in throat, sink veins, today's your last day, too slow, can't hang, don't take personal, but you must die, kill or be killed, we kill, that's why make it easy on yourself when the wolves bite, accept your fate, no struggle, don't fight, alpha or Omega, pack overpower you, reminiscing as a puff while we devour you. All my wolves blood, we thirst, kill with purse spoon. We howl.
Jump, 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 jump.
Temptation, hunger, pain, please don't forgive me.
That's M.F. Grimm, who's also known as Percy Carey, from his album The Downfall of Iblis, A Ghetto Opera, which he wrote on bail the day before he went to prison on narcotics and gun charges. Now he has a new book. It's like a graphic novel, but it's not a novel, it's a memoir. And it's called Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm, and it's about his life as a kid on Sesame Street, where he was a regular, as a rapper, as a drug dealer, as a prisoner. It's about all of that. As we said, you recorded that album right before going to prison.
Yes.
How did you deal with, like, distributing the album and getting people to listen to it while you were behind bars?
Actually, I write a lot of letters, mostly to stores, buyers. I sold my CDs right from prison. There's, for instance, Fat Beats. You got Amoeba Music. You have Sandbox. There's so many store, mom-and-pop stores, and then one-stops and distributors that I just reached out to all of them while I was incarcerated, and I kept my communication with them open.
How did it sell?
It did well. I think it sold, at the time, I think it was like 12 or 24,000. I really don't remember, because
mm-hmm.
it was a while. At the time, which was great.
You write in your book that you had a drum machine that you hid hid in your cell. How did you manage to get it in the first place, and how did you keep it hidden?
Okay, when I was in I was in a maximum security prison, There I wasn't allowed to have any type of drum machine. But when you get to a medium security prison, you're allowed to have an instrument, like, you know, like a drum machine, long as it's under a certain amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I when my classification went down, I bought it. I purchased it. But for some apparent reason, I really don't remember why, I ended up in going to somewhere and being into solitary confinement. They put me in like what's called the box. But I snuck it in there with me. I put it under my seat and I brought it in. And I just created music while I was sitting in solitary confinement. They had an electrical outlet and it worked.
Did you have to keep the volume really low so the guards wouldn't hear?
Oh, no, you can't use it like with speakers or anything. Only headphones.
Headphones, of course. Yeah. Right. Something else to keep hidden.
Yeah. I used to throw my coat over my head and just lay there and or sit in my chair with my and just tap on my drum machine. And really they didn't pay any attention because I was already in solitary confinement and it's dark, you know, it's like one little glass little mirror. That's about it. And they walk by every 45 minutes. So, you know, it was cool.
Why were you?
It saved my life.
Why were you in solitary?
See, that's what I'm trying to remember why at that particular time. I think it was a conflict of interest, the fact that I was in, I believe I sued the Department of Correction for $3 million because it wasn't wheelchair accessible, and I was denied work release at the same time because of my disability. So sometimes they would make it hard for me. They would put me in different little spots, different places. They kept moving me around, and I would sue every facility I was at. So they would get tired of it, and they would just throw me in the solitary confinement sometime until they could figure out what they would do with me. Or they'll shoot me back upstate. You know, it became a game.
Now, when you were shot, you went back to the, you know, to the gangster life. You were dealing drugs. But when you got out of prison, you changed your life.
Yes.
Why did you change it then?
My grandmother passed while I was incarcerated. And when she passed, it was like it was the last straw. I was like, okay, this is how you want her to remember you? This is how you want to be remembered? You know, her grandson is locked up in prison, you know, and she's gone now. You know, my grandmother was a very well-loved and respected woman, and It broke my heart knowing that the last image of me was the fact that I was in prison. And for me not to be able to redeem myself in her eyes, you know, it haunts me. That was the wake-up call.
Now, one of the things you've done, I know you don't like to mention for who, but one of the things you've done is you've ghost-written some raps for some pretty well-known performers.
Yes.
Where does that fall in chronologically? Was that before or after prison?
Actually, that was way before prison.
Uh-huh.
That was in my younger age. Mm-hmm. I have to say from like teens, from like 14, 15, 16, 17. Mm-hmm. You know?
If you mentioned, and I'm not asking you to, but if you mentioned who you had ghostwritten for, would they be angry because it would make them seem less authentic if they hadn't written their own raps themselves?
Yes, definitely.
Is that frustrating for you?
No, not at all. Because I put it equivalent to the fact of when at my time period, my younger age of deciding to try to be in the streets or try to sell drugs or things of that nature. It's something that I chose to do. And I knew the outcome of it. So it's the same with being a ghostwriter. There was a lot of people that they offered me money to do these things. It was, certain things were exclusively just for them. Certain things were supposed to be silent, and you have to respect that. It's funny because I've written for record companies where they would take a song and chop it up and give it to like three different artists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've seen a lot of strange things.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Percy Carey, who's also known as the rapper M.F. Grimm. His new graphic memoir, Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm, is published by Vertigo Books, part of DC Comics. It tells his story starting in the late 70s when he was a regular on Sesame Street. When he left, he headed far away from that street. He became a rapper and drug dealer and was shot several times in a murder attempt that left him paralyzed from the waist down. He served 3 years on a narcotics conviction. Since his release in 2003, he's been running his own hip-hop company, Day by Day Entertainment, and recording his own music again. I want to go back to your early days when you were on Sesame Street.
Sure.
How did you get on it? Like, what was? How did they find out about you, or you find about it? You know, how did it happen?
It was through a friend. One of my mother's close friends. She actually got me an audition, I believe, for Sesame Street. It was one of my mother's dear friends. She had a lot of ties with I think it was called Reeves Teletape at the time. It was only like two blocks away from the house, Sesame Street. And she got me in there. But I had a manager, I think her name was Toby Gibson or something to that nature. You know, so went through the whole works, but it was through a friend.
So you already knew you wanted to perform?
You know what? I wanted to be a program director since I was like 5 years old.
You're kidding. No 5-year-old knows what a program director is.
You're talking to a 37-year-old man that when he was five, I was on Sesame Street and I would constantly question how can you make us show people on this television? You know, and just, you know, create a world and then go to school. And everyone believed that world was real. And I was fascinated that they would put it on at a certain time, what would come in between. I've always wanted to be a program director, especially of ABC, since I was a kid.
That's
I'm
so
from
great.
Upper West Side. Uh-huh. Think about it. I'm from the Upper West Side, Manhattan, uh-huh. 85th Street. ABC's right on in the 60s, so I'm a special child because I've always wanted to do that.
So how old were you when you were on Sesame Street?
From 5 years old all the way up to I believe I was like maybe nine. I'm at least nine, at least till nine.
And what was your part on the show?
I was Percy. I'm the first kid to ride Snuffleupagus. Yes, it's documented that the first episode of Snuffleupagus, when Big Bird meets him and wants to see him, I'm riding on his back, but he don't see Snuffleupagus and he just sees me riding, so. It's documented. It's on the net. So it's on the internet. You can find it.
So look, when you started rapping and you started, you know, hanging out with people like Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre and stuff, did you tell them that you were the first kid to ride Snuffleupagus? I mean, was that the kind of thing that would add or detract from your cred?
Nah, I've never been ashamed of anything to that nature. But no, I didn't see it as beneficial just bringing up it and... When you're talking about, I've been offered to write Vanilla Ice, Ice Ice Baby.
Uh-huh.
That was brought to me first. The producers, I know the producers. I know when you're a writer, mm-hmm. a ghost writer, or you're a producer, it's a community. So all these things come across you. But it's funny. No, we didn't talk about Sesame Street back then, but I'm quite sure they admire me now for that. They have to.
Go ahead.
Everybody wanted to be on Sesame Street when they were kids, except me.
You didn't want to be on?
I wanted to be the program director. I wanted to put it together. I sat there long enough. I was 5 years old, seven. I realized that I can do this. I really wanted to put Sesame Street together, create new characters.
In a way, you eventually did that. It just like through having your own record company, your own, you know, your own distribution company.
Yes.
So, like, just connect the dots for me a little bit about how you got to be, you know, writing Snuffleupagus on Sesame Street to hip hop.
Okay. Well, that's what was in. That's what was done on the corners. It wasn't part of how can I say corporate America? It was part of growing up.
Mm-mm.
If you you grew up with graffiti artists, and if you didn't know how to do that, then you had to figure something out. There were break dancers. I grew up around some of the greatest break dancers in the world, Rocksteady Crew. I grew up around some of the greatest graffiti artists that they're world known. You have to find your place. But at the time, it was just things that, you know, you do. You do that to kill time. Or it's something that you really love. I became an MC. I was around some of the greatest DJs in the world.
I want to close with another track of yours. And this is from a 3-CD set that you put out not long ago. I think it was like 2006. And it's called American Hunger.
Yes.
And the track I want to play is the opening track, American Hunger, parentheses, Breakfast. and again, I'd like you to just, you know, introduce it for us, talk about it a little bit.
Well, it's amazing because you picked American Hunger, Breakfast. That started it all. On American Hunger, obviously, on breakfast, lunch, and dinner, it's the same actual sample.
I believe is the Windmills of Your Mind.
Yes.
Yes, the Marilyn Allen Bergman story. They were just on our show recently.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I couldn't decide which one I wanted to use, so I used all three different versions of it, and that's the reason why we decided to make a triple CD. That was the only reason.
Huh.
Yes. Otherwise, yeah, I couldn't put them all on one CD. It wouldn't be justified because I felt that it was powerful to be the initial one for each one. So I love it. I love breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Before we hear American Hunger, Breakfast.
Yes.
I have one final question for you. If you were programming your own TV station,
yes,
and you could choose shows from any part of television history,
yes,
what would you put on your TV station?
That's a good question. I love Channel 13.
That's the public television station in New York where you live.
Yes, yes. So I mostly documentaries I would focus on. I love the Nature Channel. I love the History Channel. If we're talking about just for me, it would be just history and nature and science. Definitely science, future. Learn what's going on. Weather Channel. I kind of like that too.
You do.
Mm-hmm.
What do you like about the Weather Channel?
Just the fact of watching them get it wrong every time, thinking that they're smarter than the creator. It's like, come on. But I have to say, if you're talking about just the Percy Channel, those that's what I would watch. Yeah, I like old Masterpiece Theater. Also, the shows from overseas, the UK back in the days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I would go with.
All right. I would go
with that.
Well, it's really been terrific to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Man, you made me feel at home. I really appreciate it.
Percy Cary, his new graphic memoir is called Sentences, The Life of M.F. Grimm. He has a new M.F. Grimm CD called The Hunt for the Gingerbread Man. Here's the track we were talking about from his CD, American Hunger.
Trying to get regurgitated because I am the feast. for hundreds of years and infinite tears with no remorse. They took us all to war. I was told you're a sinner to become a winner. Then you must put faith in the Lord. I do not choose to lead you astray, but for me, prayer don't help no more.
Over here.
It's a fight to get released. Damn, it's hard being black in America. We're under attack in America. In the belly causing gas to America. Start come out the of America. They don't want us here, they haunt us here. Lynch mobs kick in our doors. They torture us as our women and our children. Watching all 2008, not just black anymore. New objective, target poor. Those who resist, raise up a fist.